I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Martin O'Malley met on Sunday night in Charleston, South Carolina, for their last debate before the Iowa caucuses, which are on February 1st. The race between Sanders and Clinton has tightened in Iowa and in New Hampshire, and that led to a more contentious debate as they sparred over guns, health care, campaign finance, the influence of lobbyists, the influence of Wall Street, and more. Today we want to dissect some of what they said, talk about how they are covered, and also talk about their outlook on politics. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Will Bunch is senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News, who writes the Attitude blog for Philly.com. And he's just released a new ebook. It's called The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Will Bunch, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot, Marty.
Also with us is Kelly Dittmar. She's an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University in Camden. She focuses on gender and American political institutions, wrote a book called Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. And Kelly Dittmar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
We're just going to spend a little bit of time talking about Sunday night's debate because that feels almost like ancient history now, 2 days later.
Right.
But what was your takeaway, Kelly, from what you saw?
You know, I think we're always trying to look for if there's a winner. And I don't think there was a clear winner in Sunday's debate, but what you saw was that the race is close. And the two main candidates, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, were both on the defensive a little bit. So they both had to defend positions on Wall Street, healthcare, things I'm sure we'll talk about. But I also thought what was striking about Sunday's debate is sort of comparing it as well to the Republican debates. While the Republican debates have largely been focused on foreign policy, national security, what you saw in the Democratic debate was really a range of issues covered. And I think that's been a real difference between the Democratic and Republican primaries.
And Will, we really saw some pretty I won't say stark, but important differences between these two candidates, these two leading candidates.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we saw a big transition in this debate Sunday night. I mean, the early debates were all about kind of, in the case of Bernie Sanders, certainly introducing himself and introducing his ideas to America. In the case of Hillary Clinton, I think it was more putting some of the doubts about her, you know, persona and her personality to rest, which she did a very good job of. Now, as the race tightens up, they're really trying to emphasize the differences between the two of them. You know, what would be different about Bernie Sanders as a nominee versus Hillary Clinton on issues like health care, financial regulation, that sort of thing.
We were talking about this before going on the air, the difference between pragmatism, and it seems like that's really what Hillary is selling, if I can put it that way, Kelly, and idealism. And that's clearly what Bernie Sanders is about.
Yeah. You know, I think, again, we're sort of looking at a similar situation to 2008, where Hillary Clinton becomes the pragmatic candidate telling people what can be done. She's been there. She's been in the White House. She's seen it firsthand. She talks about health care and having the scars to prove her fight for it. And I think that that's been her sort of approach throughout her campaigning. Prove that she can do the work. And I should add, for women candidates, that's really important. Proving that you can get things done is something that we see as essential. On the flip side, that sort of hopefulness and progressivism that Bernie Sanders shows is really appealing to those who are frustrated with government and young people in particular.
I mean, it is interesting, Will, that a 74-year-old guy from Brooklyn is playing very well among the young people.
Exactly. And I think the reason for that is when you talk to millennial voters, when I was out doing my ebook, The Burn Identity, I spoke with dozens of these voters at Bernie Sanders rallies, and I asked them what they were looking for, and one word kept coming up again and again, and that was authenticity. You know, they don't want somebody who looks like them or talks like them necessarily, but they want somebody who they think is honest, they think who's been consistent, somebody who has a track record of standing for the same thing for decades, which is what Bernie Sanders, you know, clearly has, if nothing else. And, you know, I mean, this is the internet generation. They've grown up on a lot of phoniness, and they look for what's phony and what's real. And in this guy, they see something that they find really authentic.
I do want to play a clip from Sunday night's debate, but also thinking, Kelly, about going back to 2008 when it was Clinton versus Obama. But certainly Sunday night, Clinton was basically saying, I'll be the third term of the Obama White House.
Fascinating, right?
Fascinating.
You know, I think it was interesting. At the beginning of the campaign, she said, I'm not running for his third term. And so as she moves closer to the campaign and needs to secure that vote, I will say in Iowa, 93% favorability for Obama among Iowa caucus goers. That makes sense.
But they were also in South Carolina. It was an event hosted by an African American organization. So I'm assuming, well, she was also appealing to black voters.
Right. Race was a huge factor because the African American electorate has been her firewall. They just they don't know Bernie Sanders as well. I mean, they have this history with Clintons. I mean, Bill Clinton famously nicknamed the first black president before Obama came along, and
by Toni Morrison of all people.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And that means something. And I think also, particularly, I mean, you're starting to see a real divide among black voters. I think a lot of millennial, college attending or educated black voters are paying a lot of attention to Bernie Sanders right now. But among more like, middle class, working class, and certainly older African-American voters, there's just this loyalty with the Clintons. And also, I think there's more of a belief in transactional politics. What can you do for me? And they look at Hillary Clinton as somebody who's been around, who has a track record. Idealism doesn't really necessarily play with that type of voter as well. And I think Hillary is really trying to strengthen that relationship.
Kelly, go ahead.
I just wanted to jump in because I do think this is interesting among young voters. Sort of we paint young voters generally as supporting Bernie Sanders. But in a Harvard IOP millennial poll, which came out right before the holiday, among black millennial voters, she's up 49 to 28. So there's still that racial divide.
Right.
I think, culturally and in family, among younger voters as well as older voters.
Let me play a clip from the debate on Sunday night. And this is when they talked about health care. It's a little bit wonky, but it also, I think, highlights the differences between these two candidates. Let's give it a listen.
The Democratic Party in the United States worked since Harry Truman to get the Affordable Care Act passed. We finally have a path to universal health care. We've accomplished so much already. I do not want to see the Republicans repeal it, and I don't want to see us start over again with a contentious debate. I want us to defend and build on the Affordable Care Act and improve it.
Okay.
Senator Sanders.
Secretary Clinton didn't answer your question. Because what her campaign was saying, Bernie Sanders, who has fought for universal health care for my entire life, he wants to end Medicare and Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program. That is nonsense. What a Medicare for All program does is finally provide in this country health care for every man, woman, and child as a right. Now, the truth is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, you know what they believed in? They believed that health care should be available to all of our people. I'm on the committee that wrote the Affordable Care Act. I made the Affordable Care Act, along with Jim Clyburn, a better piece of legislation. I voted for it. But right now, what we have to deal with is the fact that 29 million people still have no health insurance.
I mean, Will, that's really showing the pragmatist. This is Hillary Clinton saying, let's build on the Affordable Care Act. And Sanders is saying, this is a right. We need Medicare for all. And we have some ideas now about what he's talking about as well.
Right. And I think politically this is a conversation that's really happening at two different levels. One is the real world specifics of healthcare. And I think Hillary Clinton makes an excellent point. I mean, I think when you think about the reality of dredging this issue up again and having to deal with the Republican Congress and just what a political slog that would be, it's a pretty intimidating thought. On the other hand, this is a debate to win the heart and soul of the Democratic primary electorate. I mean, you're talking about people. Why does somebody become an enthusiastic liberal Democrat? Usually because they're an idealist. So it's kind of like, instead of rock, paper, scissors, it's kind of like a game of like rock, paper, where like if you're the idealist, you're the rock. I mean, you're almost always – you can't lose. You're always going to win because the heart – of the Democratic primary voter is always going to go for the guy who say, why settle? Why compromise? Why can't we do better? And I think that's the level of the conversation that Bernie, not so much the practical details level of the conversation, but the more spiritual level of the conversation, really.
And Kelly, I thought it was interesting as Bernie Sanders talked about FDR, Truman, that they believed this was a right, but neither of those presidents were able to get universal health care system through the Congress that they had to deal with.
Exactly. And I think that this is where Hillary Clinton's in a bit of an awkward spot. So she's been criticized about criticizing Bernie Sanders on this Medicare for All plan. And I think it's because of the way she's doing it, right? She's trying to say, to not be overly pragmatic and to say that, in fact, this is going to hurt progressive politics. This is going to hurt the policy. Whereas what she really probably wants to say is these presidents weren't able to get it done. We tried in our administration, in the Clinton administration. We tried again with the Obama administration. This isn't going to happen. And barring that, let's not relitigate. Let's not open this up. One of, you know, Paul Krugman today in the New York Times said this is one of the biggest victories for progressive politics, you know, in decades. And so why would we want to open that up again?
And that doesn't really fit on a bumper sticker, does it? Versus Medicare for all.
Well, it doesn't do, you know, it doesn't do what Will said. It doesn't sort of inspire the most progressive to say we should fight harder.
Did you want to add to that, Will?
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right on the money, you know, and I think it's a difficult position for Hillary to be in. And that's, you know, it's what happened to her in 2008. And it's interesting to see history so far going at least a little bit down the same road anyway so far.
I think that the one thing she has going for her this time is if you have a sort of Paul Krugman or other folks talking for her, you know, sort of saying and sort of vouching for her and saying, you know what, the realistic approach is the right approach. Mm-hmm. Progressives respect some of these folks, you know, depending on who it is.
You had a piece, an interesting piece that you sent over to us, Kelly. This is just about volume, how people speak. And I think it, even if you're a fan of Sanders, it's clear he speaks at a really loud volume. But when a woman speaks loudly, how do people generally react?
Yeah, you know, this is something Hillary Clinton's dealt with. There's been multiple articles around her voice and commentary on it. And we know that people respond differently to women's voices, to women's appearance than they do to men. And so I thought it was fascinating watching these debates and seeing people sort of tweeting, you know, why is Bernie yelling at me? And laughing about it, we sort of SNL satirize it. But for women, I think if Hillary Clinton was sort of using the same tone on stage, we'd probably wince a little bit and folks would be talking about that.
Will, you want to add to that?
I was just going to say the first time I saw Bernie Sanders in the debate, the one they had in Las Vegas, I was thinking about This Is Spinal Tap when the speaker gets turned up to 11. It's
all
like,
right.
Although I thought in his case he was like 13. And the thing is, I mean, you get used to it, but it is, I think Kelly makes a great point, and it is interesting. And, you know, I mean, you know, it's sad that this is still true in 2016. But if you're a female candidate, you have a lot of, you know, you have to balance so many things. I mean, you have to show that you're tough when you're dealing with a primary electorate that generally is, you know, more pacifist, you know, and you have to show that you can get things done in a primary electorate that tends to be more idealist, you know, and Bernie Sanders, I don't think has those obstacles as much. I think he's more free to say, here's my ideal world, and I'm just going to fight for it, and that's it.
Let's take a very short break. Kelly, I know you want to say something, but we do need to take a break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about the Democrats running for the White House, specifically the tightening race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, certainly in Iowa and also in New Hampshire. Will Bunch is a senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. He's got a new book out. It's an e-book about Bernie Sanders called The Burn Identity. Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus, and she's got a book called Navigating Gendered Terrain. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kelly Dittmar and Will Bunch about the Democrats, the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, the race for the nomination for the White House. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We've been talking some about the debate, which was on Sunday night. And let me play another clip. This has to do with Wall Street and with banks and financial institutions. And Sanders had criticized Clinton for taking speaker fees, pretty generous speaker fees from Goldman Sachs. And let's give it a listen.
When you have three out of the four largest banks today bigger than they were when we bailed them out because they were too big to fail, when you have the six largest financial institutions having assets of 60% of the GDP of America, it is very clear to me what you have to do. You got to bring back a 21st century Glass-Steagall legislation, and you got to break up these huge financial institutions. They have too much economic power, and they have too much financial power over our entire economy. If Teddy Roosevelt were alive today, the old Republican trust buster, what he would say is, these guys are too powerful, break them up, I believe that's what the American people want to see. That's my view.
Secretary Clinton, help the voter understand the daylight between the two of you here.
Well, there's no daylight on the basic premise that there should be no bank too big to fail and no individual too powerful to jail. We agree on that. But where we disagree is the comments that Senator Sanders has made that don't just affect me, I can take that, but he's criticized President Obama for taking donations from Wall Street. And President Obama has led our country out of the Great Recession. Senator Sanders called him weak, disappointing. He even in 2011 publicly sought someone to run in a primary against President Obama.
So, Will, the question is, can you take money from Wall Street, whether through speaker fees or campaign donations, and then be tough about Wall Street reforms?
I think this is one of the strongest selling points for Bernie Sanders' campaign, to be honest. I think this is a huge Achilles heel for Hillary Clinton because, you know, facts are stubborn things, as the saying goes. And the fact is, Hillary Clinton has, well, two things. One, she's received an enormous amount of campaign contributions from Wall Street. You know, we've saw Politico did a story last year that basically talked to a lot of people at Goldman Sachs, and they said, we'd be happy with two people, either Jeb Bush or Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I mean, that's the real world, and that speaks a lot. I mean, the other thing we've seen is just the amount of speaking fees that Hillary Clinton has received, and also her husband, Bill Clinton.
Hundreds of thousands, right? Or maybe even millions now. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, more money than the average American citizen will make in their lifetime for speaking to these groups. And, you know, when it comes to corruption, it's just the appearance, you know, regardless of whether she's actually lifted a finger to help these banks and financial institutions, the appearance of it is terrible. And the truth is, I think probably most Americans, but definitely most Democratic primary voters feel that, you know, it's an outrage that nobody went to jail for the financial abuses of the 2000s. They feel that, you know, they've seen profits and Wall Street bonuses come roaring back, and they've seen, you know, roughly 99% of all the new income that's been created in the last decade has gone to people in the top 1%. You know, wages for the average middle class family and the average working class person stays flat. And no matter how much they approve or disapprove of President Obama's performance, and most Democrats highly approve of President Obama's performance, but they still think more. This is the area where they feel that more needs to be done.
And what do you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, we're going back to sort of the pragmatist a little piece of this. You know, so she represented New York. And so I think her defense of some of the donations and work with Wall Street is fair. For those of us who sort of understand representative politics and realize that she represented an area and had to walk that line about protecting some of Wall Street, but also holding them accountable, which has been her line, that's not as popular amongst those who want to sort of throw it out. I will say as well, she also has a challenge in that most former presidents have been paid big bucks to go talk in front of Wall Street interest, as well as first ladies. Bernie Sanders represents Vermont, is a sitting member of the U.S. Senate, cannot take speaking fees. So not to say that he would or that they would invite him. But I do think that there is a stark difference here. All of these things, however, are minutiae. And so how does she sort of make a clear statement of her support for reform and her, you know, standing up to the banks to an electorate that's really concerned that she's not strong enough to do that, or that she in some ways is going to be biased. And I think what we see from the folks that are in politics, in the Senate, in the House, they do take money from big banks, and they still hold them accountable. But it's hard for the American electorate, I think, sometimes to see that that's possible.
Well, and I wonder whether for Sanders, Will, the gun issue is – I'm not saying it's his Achilles heel, but he has represented Vermont, very sort of live-free – is it? I always forget whether –
that's New Hampshire. Yeah, right.
I stand Cross corrected. But nonetheless, has that – I mean, it's a big hunter state, and he is – he has a track record when it comes to things like guns. He is representing the people of his state, but this has hurt him, I think, a little bit among some progressives.
Right. I think deservedly so. I think most progressives are outraged at the level of mass shootings in this country, and you know they want a much more forceful approach. And there's no question that Bernie Sanders' record on guns is not the record that your typical progressive Democratic primary voter would want to see. And it's not terrible. His record's not terrible. I mean, he points out numerous times, he has a D-minus rating from the NRA. He has been firm on things like assault weapons, but he did vote against the Brady Bill.
He did.
And
yes.
He did vote to give liability to gun manufacturers, and that's
liability protection.
Right? Yeah. Excuse me. And that's something. And that's something that just politically he has to live with. I don't think you're ever going to find somebody who's going to be 100% of what a primary vote. And voters have to look at the pros and cons on both sides. But I think for a liberal voter, that's something they have to come to terms with Bernie's votes on that issue.
Kelly, let me ask you another question about Hillary Clinton. And I see a lot of people want to join the conversation. Do you think she has a double whammy in that she is both a woman running for president and she's also Hillary Clinton running for president, in terms of either the baggage that she might have or also the barriers that she has to climb over?
Sure. And I think she's sort of talked about this in this cycle much more openly than she talked about in the last cycle. So there's definitely a part of this that's when you're Clinton, you can never be the change, right? So when you look among voters who want change, she's not going to be their candidate. They see it as a dynasty. They see her as being in the system too long. But at the same point, she's facing some of the things that we see women candidates face over and over and over again. And it's sort of surprising to me that she's still seeing them in this cycle. So things about questions about her qualifications, questions that she can handle the job, if she can be grandmother and president. We don't ask the same things of men. And so I do think some of the coverage, some of the treatment have been things that she's experienced her whole life and through her whole campaign. And one big difference this time, I think, is that she's sort of embracing her gender. Mm-hmm. And the advantages that it can bring, instead of last time when she focused really strongly on proving she was man enough for the job.
Well, it's interesting, Will, she was asked about her husband, about Bill Clinton, what role he might play if she becomes president. And she said, we'll be sitting around the kitchen table talking.
and we'll see where it goes from there.
But right. It is a kind of twofer argument that he made when he was running for president, which is you get me and you get her. She's saying you get me and you get him.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird that the other male candidates don't get asked about their spouses more. I know in the case of Bernie Sanders, his wife Jane, former college president, very dynamic personality, somebody who spending the time I did out on the campaign trail doing the ebook, is somebody who kind of counterbalances the more prickly aspects of his personality. She's a more, when they come into a room, she's the one who actually makes the eye contact with the voters, and if there is a Bernie Sanders administration, she would play a hugely important role. And it's kind of weird and kind of reverse sexist, mm-hmm. that doesn't even get asked in the debates. But, I think going back to the original point, I think you asked a great question because, there is the issue of feminist, critiques about whether Hillary's up to the job. And then there's the issue of the baggage of being from the Clintons. I mean, those things they get commingled all the time, and it really is unfair. I mean, they're totally separate. I mean, the idea that there's any particular obstacle for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman is ridiculous. On the other hand, I think the record of the Clinton presidency and her role in it is totally fair game.
Sure.
One of the reasons I got interested in this race was the contrast between, there's a few years age difference, but they're basically both from that generation that came of age during the 1960s, and one became this compromiser, this triangulator, and one stayed this idealist. To me, that contrast just fascinated me. So
go ahead, Kelly, and then we'll get to our callers.
I'll jump in. One thing that's interesting, we know that women voters don't just vote for women, and that's sort of a false idea that's often put out there. At the same point in this primary, it's been fascinating to see the gender gap in Hillary Clinton support more broadly, showing that men are, supporting Bernie Sanders in much higher numbers than they are Hillary Clinton. And on the flip side, Hillary Clinton really strongly dominates women's votes in the Democratic primary. To me, that's sort of evidence there is something going on there, right? And among men in particular, some folks have written, well, maybe it's the sort of feminism among men that's the problem. It isn't that women are any more likely to support Hillary Clinton. And I sort of wonder if that's true, right? Sure. Is there something to that discomfort with seeing a woman in a role that she's never held before?
That's Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at the Camden campus. She focuses on gender and American political political institutions, wrote a book about it called Navigating Gender Terrain. Will Bunch with us as well, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. He writes the Attitude blog for Philly.com, and he's got a new book, an e-book just out about Bernie Sanders called The Burn Identity. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Ed from, looks like Lansdale, to join the conversation. Hi, Ed. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Basically, if Hillary was in the White House when Bill signed the deregulation that came from previous administrations.
Glass-Steagall?
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's what it got rid of.
Right.
Right. How does she intend to be serious about what happened and caused the nominally, you know, no quote unquotes, no caps, recent Great Recession? It wasn't as bad as 1930. I come from a family that went through it. I'm a blue collar, looking toward retirement. And I've always had FDR.
You know what, Ed?
Let me
take your essential question. And Will, if I can perhaps put this back to you, and this gets a little bit into the weeds of having to do with Glass-Steagall and, you know, what actually caused the recession. I think there were multiple things at play that created our most recent recession, you know, near depression. But does she have some baggage, I guess, from her husband's years?
Well, again, you have to divide it up, I think, into two segments. I mean, segment one is was repealing Glass-Steagall, which was done under the Bill Clinton presidency with Congress, of course, as well. Was that a good idea? And no, I think it was one of the worst things that happened during Bill Clinton's presidency, you know, because he created the situation where banks could get involved in insurance, in other types of instruments that these banks, you know, had no business being in, and which played a major role in causing the 2008 crash. But you know, when we're talking about Hillary Clinton,
right,
was she deeply involved in that part of the process? I mean, you know, it's healthcare is different. She was very involved in healthcare. I think if you want to talk about healthcare in the 90s, Hillary Clinton's fair game. I don't think she was directly as involved in the financial. So I think when you're talking about it, the more question is, what would they do now? You know, would they reinstate Glass-Steagall,
right,
and those type of visions now? I mean, I think that's the relevant question for 2016.
And what's so interesting, Kelly, if you go back to the 1990s, Obamacare sounded an awful lot like what the Republicans were talking about, you know, the mandate.
Right, yeah.
A Republican idea then sort of gets convoluted and turned into the Affordable Care Act.
Sure, and it demonstrates sort of the politics of reality. What's going to happen and what are the barriers and constraints? I also think on financial reform, what Bernie Sanders' inclusion in this race has done is make Hillary Clinton talk about what she will do to rein in the banks. And I think that that's really the benefit of having a fruitful debate. This is what campaigns are for. And so you saw her put out a New York Times op-ed in December about how she'd rein in the banks. Those sorts of things are, you know, her saying, I am going to do this, I am serious about this, and sort of pushing back against claims that she would be tied to her husband's administration.
And thanks for the call. Let's see what Lily from Columbus, New Jersey has to say. Lily, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. My question has to do with the difference between idealism and pragmatism. The Democrats managed to put the Affordable Care Act into place. And yes, it was very, very difficult, but it's there and it's not going anywhere. So why wouldn't you try to present a single-payer system and try to get it in? Why wouldn't you vote for Bernie Sanders if he fails and he can't do it? Okay, we still have the Affordable Care Act, so we are where we started. To me, it's like equating when black people were no longer slaves, telling them, well, you're not a slave anymore, so now you want the right to vote. You're a woman and you're a black woman. You want the right to vote. Isn't it enough? You're not a slave.
Lily, let me take your comments. I'm looking at you, Kelly. I mean, I think think I understand what Lily's talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying, right, is why isn't it okay to say we want more? And that's what Bernie Sanders is saying. But I think that the Clinton argument and people who are fearful about opening up this debate are saying it isn't just building on. What he's offering is actually changing the system. So if you look at, even though his plan isn't very detailed yet, if you look at the pay for, it's very different, right? It's very different than how we pay for the Affordable Care Act. Once you start playing with those mechanisms, you open up the legislation. And that's a real concern for those who know that once you do that, those who are ready to attack, I mean, they voted against the Affordable Care Act over 60 times now in the Congress. So why open it up to that scrutiny?
Well, it seems Hillary Clinton is saying, let's build on what we have.
Exactly.
Let's not keep it the status quo. Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say about Bernie Sanders. I mean, the flip side, and I think a lot of voters think, is look, these Republicans in Congress won't approve anything. They don't support anything. So that being the case, why not have somebody pushing for what's right? You know, but, I mean, it's kind of push for what's right,
even if it's not going to happen.
Right. Is rather why. You know, I mean, well, one of the complaints though against Obama was that he tried too much to compromise with these people who weren't compromisers. I mean, Occupy Wall Street came about really as a result of this effort to get this grand bargain and with this debt ceiling compromise of 2011, when the Republicans were entrenched and people felt Obama went too far to give them what they want, and then that's when you saw, you know, very progressive people kind of rising up in the streets because of that. And I think that set the seeds for Bernie Sanders' candidacy. Mm-hmm. You know, just real quickly, just one other thing about this whole pragmatism versus idealism thing is, you know, I think one thing people forget about Bernie Sanders and his defense is he has a long track record of being an elected official, including he was an administrator for 8 years. He ran the city of Burlington. I've been there. It's not a huge city, but it is a city. It has all the governing challenges that any entity has. He came in there with very idealistic ideas about, you know, breaking up, you know, utility monopolies and that sort of thing. He had a very hostile council, and he ran the city very pragmatically. And, I think you could assume he would be the same kind of president.
We are talking about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. They are running for president of the United States. You might not know that. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow. I'm talking with Kelly Dittmar and Will Bunch about the Democratic presidential campaign. It's getting more interesting. Kind of a feisty debate on Sunday night between the two front runners. We do want to talk a bit about Martin O'Malley. He was there as well. Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at Camden, wrote a book called Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. He writes the Attitude blog for Philly.com. And his new ebook is called The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. And again, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. A Facebook comment from Pat O'Malley, ? Is he prepping for 2020, 2024, VP or cabinet? Kelly, you want to jump in on that?
Sure. I'm not sure what O'Malley's endgame is anymore. At the beginning of the race, I thought he might stick around for a little bit and then sort of put his support behind the front runner, and that would position him potentially for an appointment. I don't think that either candidate, whoever will be the Democratic nominee, is looking for relatively moderate white male from Maryland to add to their ticket. So at this point, I'm not quite sure, and I think O'Malley's struggling a little bit with what his role is currently in the Democratic race.
And he's at around 5%. I think it was 4.5, and they moved it up to 5 just to get him in.
Will? Yeah, I mean, I think O'Malley's campaign was, well, predicated on a couple things. One, possibly the idea that, you know, Hillary Clinton would implode, the email scandal or something, which clearly is not going to happen, I don't think. But I think the other thing that animates his candidacy was just the idea that for 225 years, America's pretty much elected people who look like him. You know, he's, you know, a young white guy. He's well, you know, he certainly speaks very well in a debate setting. He's, you know, he's got a certain bit of what used to be called charisma, but voters, he's just totally off the mood at the time. I mean, voters want authentic. They want the grumpy grandfather. They don't want the, you know, they don't want the too slick, you know. And I think when the riots in Baltimore happened and people thought about his record on crime and punishment in Baltimore. I think for the average Democratic primary voter, that was just the death knell for even giving him a second thought.
It's interesting. Kelly Will talks about the grumpy grandfather. Mm-hmm. That would be Bernie Sanders. Yeah. Then we have the angry billionaire. That would be Donald Trump. I mean, it is a curious time in our political life here.
It is. And I was saying this earlier, you know, it's fascinating, again, talking about sort of gender dynamics. We know from research that likability is something that's of particular concern to women candidates because in research it's tied to perceptions of their qualifications to lead. For men, those two things are separate. So we elect guys that we don't like. We're much more hesitant to elect women we don't like. And I think we see this in the criticism and scrutiny of Hillary Clinton and the folks saying, I don't know, I just don't like her.
Do you think the same is true for Carly Fiorina?
I think there's a little bit of that, for sure. And she's talked about it a little bit herself.
She has.
There's something about, you know, her voice and her face. There's just something about her that I don't like. And you hear that among focus groups and among voters. And some of that, at least, is tied to gender, I believe.
And you see quotes all the time from people who have serious qualms about Trump, the same thing, you know, his voice and his face and his hair, you know, and everything, you know, and people have doubts about it. But you keep hearing these people saying, but he tells it like it is, which, of course, he doesn't. I mean, he's very dishonest.
Right.
But to a certain kind of ear and people who've been, you know, trained to view American life in a certain way, they feel like that he's not politically correct and he's telling it like it is. Mm. And they don't have to like him. They like the fact that they think he's speaking his mind, you know, and that. And that appeals to them.
We have, looks like John from Fishtown joining us on Radio Times. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I just had a kind of a quick observation. Bernie Sanders seems to have less of the alpha male quality than even Hillary Clinton does. She seems to be a more dominant personality, in my opinion, especially the kind of when the Black Lives Matter took over his stage. The way that he responded to that may have been very diplomatic, but it didn't seem to be a very strong character personality there to me. But I'd like the opinions on that and how that might play out with the voters. But also, I'd like to comment that a lot of political commentators, especially I've noticed it in this conversation, seem to be pronouncing huge as if it were spelled with a Y now, which I find interesting.
That's very, very funny, John. Thank you. Yes, huge. I get it. You have talked about, written about, Kelly, this sort of whole alpha male thing ascribed to female candidates, I guess in particular Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've said all along the way, we're doing a project for the Center for American Women in Politics called Presidential Gender Watch. And part of this was to sort of elevate the gender dialogue in the race. And one thing that I've said repeatedly is that everybody in this race is playing the gender card. And what I mean by that is every candidate is trying to prove they're man enough for the job, because this job has been one that's been held by men and defined by masculinity for so long. So again, New York Times this morning does a piece about the machismo that Marco Rubio is putting out because his opponents are trying to emasculate him, right? So Donald Trump is calling him weak or a boy. So all of these candidates are always sort of trying to prove that they're masculine enough. So I think this is sort of true with Bernie Sanders, that he's not trying so hard. But by nature of being a man, he doesn't have to try very hard. For Hillary Clinton, she has to walk a real fine line in proving she's tough enough, but also talking a little bit about why having a woman in the White House might bring something different but advantageous.
And Chris Christie said some version, Will, about Marco Rubio, that Hillary Clinton would, you know, walk all over him or some version of that. In a certain way, emasculinizing Marco Rubio. So interesting kind of macho dimension here.
Yeah, and it's sad. But one thing, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, but I think, you know, I think it's easier for a man to be, you know, of all the candidates in the race, I think Bernie Sanders has more of a record as a pacifist than being an anti-war person. He doesn't oppose all wars, but he's more anti-war. But I think, you know, I think being a male frees him up to do that in a way that I think, unfortunately, for your average successful female candidate, like a Hillary Clinton, it's almost impossible to be pacifist. And you've seen her take very hard stands, you know, from Libya to Iraq to whatever. And, you know, maybe that's just what she believes. Mm. But I think it's also something that's kind of imposed on her as a female candidate. And that's not fair.
We have an email from Paul who says, I know many people are fed up with the two-party duopoly. If Trump is not nominated by the Republicans and decides to run third party, might Sanders win as a fourth party if Hillary is nominated. I mean, you've covered Bernie Sanders, Will.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see him? You know, I'm asking you to get into his head, which is not fair. But
yeah.
Let's say Hillary does win the nomination. What do you imagine Bernie Sanders doing or not doing?
Yeah, I don't see him running as independent. I think, you know, look, I think memories of 2000 and when just really a handful of votes for Ralph Nader gave the presidency to George W. Bush. And as a result, you know, you had a war and an economic disaster as a result. And I think that, you know, that horrible memory for most, at least for most people on the left, the center left side of the electorate, that memory is never faded. I don't see Bernie Sanders do that. I mean, for me, the question along the similar lines that fascinates me is what happened. I mean, every day it seems more and more possible that you could actually see Trump and Bernie Sanders emerging as the nominees. That it's still, you know, it's still not the favorite, but that's definitely a possibility at this point. And then if that happens, does Michael Bloomberg, for example, you know, somebody who says, look, you know, we have a socialist on one side, we have a person some people have even called a fascist on the other side, we need somebody, you know, who's sensible, you know, and
with a lot of money, obviously.
With a lot of, yeah, well, it's going to be somebody like Michael Bloomberg with a lot of money if that does happen. And I mean, what kind of crazy election would that be? I mean, this could really be one for the history books. I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Do you want to spin out any theories for us, Kelly?
I just think that the one, you know, huge, there's a lot of differences between Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. One huge difference is that Bernie Sanders, I genuinely believe, got in this race to push the envelope and to push Hillary Clinton towards the left. And I think he's still, while he's enamored, I think, a little bit with leading and being so successful, I think that's still his primary goal, which means he would not run against her because ultimately he wants to see a strong Democratic candidate win, surprisingly enough, as an independent.
Well, and I think he's been successful in moving her to the left,
wouldn't you
say?
That's right. And I think on the flip side, right, Donald Trump has been in this for the attention and to win, and he'll tell you that repeatedly.
And for himself, yeah.
I mean, and that's huge. Let me get Sam from, it looks like Devin, to join our conversation. Hi, Sam. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you. I was calling in to ask your guests what they think about Bernie's anger management problem. When John McCain ran, we had the debates, and the one where they each had a stool to sit on, Obama and McCain, and Obama would sit on his stool and listen, and John McCain would talk to the audience, and then it would be Obama's turn, and McCain was incapable of standing still. He would pace up and down. He might make faces. He just couldn't control himself because he kept wanting to jump in. I see the same thing with Bernie in the debate. Oh. I mean, he is an angry person, and I don't know if we need an angry president to be on the world stage where he's yelling at people. And I'm wondering about 4 years of being yelled at and 8 years of being yelled at.
Well, Sam, let me toss that back to Will because he's done a book about Bernie Sanders. Do you think he has an anger management problem?
Well, I will say that that might be an extreme way of characterizing it, but I do know that time and time again he's been described as a difficult person to work. You know, you do these surveys of Washington's most difficult bosses. He's a demanding boss. As you might expect, when he arrived in Congress as an independent, he ruffled a lot of feathers, even among people he might think would be allies. Most famously, Barney Frank. Barney Frank couldn't stand Bernie Sanders. And you would think,
well, Barney
you
Frank think is a be, prickly guy himself.
Of course. And that's the kind of dynamic you see in
Congress. Couple hours with
yeah,
him in
yeah,
the studio.
Right, yeah,
yes.
That's the kind of dynamic you see in Congress all the time. But, you know, I think what you're going to see happen, I think, is you see if and it seems to be the case, if Bernie Sanders keeps rising in the polls and the idea of him as the nominee becomes more plausible, you're going to see, I think, a little bit more attention play to his personality and his persona. I mean, right now the focus has been largely on his ideas, which is exactly what he wants, and it's been great. But, you know, if you're going to play at the highest level, people are going to start, I think, looking at your personality more closely.
Let me read a couple of comments here. An email from Matt. He says, I think Hillary Clinton is too cynical. An email from Ron. Hillary may not have been my first choice, but how can any Democrat seriously think that Bernie can win win the general election. Facebook comment from Steve. Bernie advocates $15 living wage. Hillary says $12. My problem with her is she compromises before negotiations have even begun. Kelly, you want to jump in on any of those comments?
Sure. I mean, so I think on the compromise, yes. You know, sort of her approach, again, going back to what we started with, her approach is to say, I'm going to get things done. And to do that, we're going to need to compromise and we're going to need to be realistic. Also, I will say on sort of how can anybody support anybody else? I think there is a firewall that Hillary Clinton has that's very strong after New Hampshire. So even if Bernie Sanders wins Iowa and New Hampshire, the gap by which she's leading in South Carolina and in Super Tuesday states is huge, to say the least. And so I think he really has a real large barrier in front of him, even if he wins in those two states. And so I think those folks who want to see somebody lead and that nomination wrapped up quickly are going to say, I think we should put our support behind Clinton.
I mean, do we put too much emphasis on Iowa and New Hampshire, Will?
To some degree, because, you know, clearly, I mean, the last two Iowa caucus winners on the Republican side have been Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee. So, you know, that should tell you something there. But it matters. I'm sorry, I was wanting to respond to one of the other commenters about, you know, could Bernie stand in a general election? I mean, one thing we've seen, and this doesn't surprise me in the least, but it was interesting that during the debate on Sunday night, you had the Republican Party fact checkers coming to Bernie's defense and going after Hillary. So clearly, I think the thinking within the Republican Party is that they would much rather run against Bernie Sanders than against Hillary Clinton. And it's funny because so now they're kind of being patronizingly nice almost in some ways to Bernie Sanders on some level. But, you know, if he gets to be the nominee, I mean, we saw this in 2008 with Hillary Clinton and with Obama, whereas, like, they kind of said nice things about Obama until he was the nominee.
Yes.
And then this flood of books, and he's not a citizen, and he's a Kenyan, and, you know, all this crazy stuff. So, I mean, you can't even begin to imagine what the onslaught against Bernie Sanders if he were to somehow become the Democratic nominee. It would be unbelievable.
An email from Matthew says, I want Sanders to be the nominee just so I can see him debate Trump. Although I think Hillary could give Trump a run for his money.
I mean, again, in some ways you can compare the sort of Sanders and Trump idealism in very different directions. They have very different positions. But Hillary Clinton against Trump in a debate would be very much about what is realistic and what are the facts versus what you're talking about and sort of holding Trump accountable. I think that would be a fascinating debate. I think that the Republican Party is hoping to God that that is not the debate that they see. I think the establishment is really hoping that the other candidates somehow find a way to take the lead.
But here you have these voters saying, oh, my God, I couldn't wait to see a Trump, you know, Bernie or a Trump Hillary debate. And, you know, I mean, to me, and it's a little bit strained from our initial topic, but one of the fascinating things about this 2016 election is, I mean, a trend that's been coming to roost for decades in American life, which is the merging of entertainment and politics. And Donald Trump is just the, you know, epitome of that trend. And look at the debates we're talking about. I mean, the TV ratings for the debates are just way up this year, even on the Democratic side.
Yes, they are.
But on the Republican side, they're just off the charts. And that's because of the Donald Trump factor. And people are entertained by Donald Trump. And is that how we want to elect the president of the United States based on how entertaining they are? It's a very scary time in some ways on that level, you know.
Well, we could go on much more to talk about. The clock is telling me we have to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. A really great discussion. Will Bunch, senior writer at the Philadelphia Daily News. He authors the Attitude blog for Philly.com. That's ATTYTOOD. That's how we talk here in Philadelphia. He's got a new ebook, and it's called The Burn Identity, A Search for Bernie Sanders and the New American Dream. Will, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
And Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University at their Camden campus. She focuses on gender and American political institutions, wrote a book called Navigating Gendered Terrain, Stereotypes and Strategy in Political Campaigns. Kelly Dittmar, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We have hour two, and we'll be right back.